Entertainment Weekly called Rachel Klein's first novel, What to Keep, quote, striking, sparkling, chick lit for smarties. And she's probably bristled ever since. But Rachel Klein writes smart chick lit in the great tradition of chick lit. I mean Jane Austen, Barbara Pym, Anne Beatty, or Laurie Colwin. These are women writers who do what women so often do better than men. Observe our various societies with a journalist's unflinching eye. Tell us exactly what those people are thinking and feeling, and bring out what is the best and the worst and the funniest in us all. What to Keep explored Denny Roman's life from 12 years old to 36 as she struggles through girlhood to hard-won happiness near midlife. Rachel Klein's new novel, My Liar, follows Annabeth, a Minnesota transplant to L.A., and her starts and fits career as a film editor. Although My Liar is primarily a story about artistic integrity, in Rachel Klein's fiction, it sometimes barely matters what her story is about. The important thing is why they are about, or why we do and say what we do, as Klein definitely puts us in so many people's heads, or rather, our own heads. Whether it's the minutia of choosing a hairstylist, or navigating landmines and self-doubt at Hollywood networking parties, or literary parties, or any other kind of annoying party for that matter, or deciding who or who not to love, or finding perspective on an ex-boyfriend's suicide, Rachel Klein, like so many of the best women writers, goes after the big issues with a scalpel and tweezers, not a battle axe. And like so many of the best women writers, she never overlooks the miniatures that make up our daily lives, giving us a character who surely wishes she could employ her scalpel-like editing skills on her own life, usually about 15 minutes after the fact, don't we all? And edit her own story. Rachel Klein did indeed write screenplays and teleplays in Los Angeles from 1990 to 1999, also teaching screenwriting at USC, though she is a native and current resident of Brooklyn, New York. What to Keep, which appeared in 2004, was a Ballantine Reader's Circle book, and her new novel, My Liar, just appeared this spring. Please welcome Rachel Klein.
Paul, can you hear me? Is that good? All right. Thank you so much, Richard. That was a tough act to follow. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. And although I am a native and current resident of Brooklyn, New York, half of my family's from this part of the world, so really I'm not an outsider. So I wanted to... the book's called My Liar, and a lot of the themes in it are about using the stories of one's own life as manipulatively in order to achieve effects in friendship and in work. And, somebody always has to say Rachel Klein lived in Los Angeles for 10 years as though to justify the book. And so I'm going to start out reading you a essay that's actually true. That's about me, and then I'm going to read you a couple sections about the book, and hopefully you can sort of see where the truth ends and the stories begin. And if not, just bear with me. Hi, my name is Rachel, and I'm a writer. That's what I used to have to say at the group I attended in a church basement in Santa Monica. It was called, I kid you not, Artists Anonymous. We followed the 12 steps and said the Serenity Prayer at the end of every meeting, just like the alcoholics, junkies, and sex addicts who used the room on the other nights of the week. I guess it made sense to me at the time, but when exactly was that time? I can't remember. I lived in LA for almost 10 years, but I can never remember what happened to me when while I was there. Every memory seems tied to an instance of driving down a sunny stretch of road, listening to National Public Radio, trying not to spill any more latte. Sometimes I'm driving with a splitting headache, which must mean I'm on the east side or in the valley. Sometimes the ocean is glittering nearby. I'm always wondering when I will discover that this, my life in LA, is all in my imagination. It seems impossible to me that I can live in a place where I can afford to own a car and live in a neighborhood that is fragrant with jasmine and orange blossoms, that I can shop in supermarkets where the produce I used to buy in New York would be laughed out of even the discount bins. I'm always thinking those things, so none of them help me isolate when any particular memory is set. Occasionally, I can remember the jacarandas being in bloom, which means, I think, June, but it still doesn't tell me what year. Because I'm a writer, I care about the sequence of things, even things that happened to me. If I tell you that I attended the Oscars, and then that I was raped, and then that I had a car accident that resulted in amnesia, that's a very different story than if I tell you that I had the car accident first, then was raped, and finally attended the Oscars, right? So here are some of the memorable things that happened to me in Los Angeles. I was awakened from a sound sleep by a very big earthquake. It would be easy enough to look up the date on this one, but the point is I can't remember it. Not even what month. I remember waking up to the sounds of dogs going crazy, and then when the crashing started, realizing that the window directly over my head was suddenly a guillotine, and that staying where I was, even though there was a doorway 3 feet away, was all I could do. I was quite certain that I was going to die, and in that case, I wanted to stay in bed. My friend Dan, who lived about a mile to the north, showed up with a flashlight 40 minutes later. I was fine, but I still feel like he saved my life. I got a job on Knott's Landing. I made a ton of money. I worked with 4 other writers who were smart and thoughtful, and sometimes we laughed until we wept. Then we all got fired. Start to finish, the whole thing lasted less than 6 months. I remember watching dailies for an episode with Halle Berry in it, and I'd said her character was the kind of girl who would put silk handkerchiefs over her bedside lamps, and there they were in the dailies, red silk. I spent a year too depressed to get out of bed. Which year? There is no image to go with this. Picture an unmade bed. I saw a shrink who began each session by handing me a roll of masking tape with which I was supposed to draw a safe boundary around myself. I spent a lot of time looking at his socks, which had pictures of golf tees on them. The riots, a.k.a. the disturbance, came. This, of course, took place after the Rodney King verdict. Or was it the O.J. verdict? All I can remember is driving west on the 10 freeway and seeing all these fires on the left, and then watching it all on TV, and then being in a truckload of well-meaning West Siders who shoveled charred refuse and broken glass for a day, a beautiful sunny day. I turned 40. A friend threw me a dinner party at her splendid, elegantly decorated house. The guest star was a dispirited psychic who couldn't even muster the moxie to tell me I would eventually meet the man of my dreams. At dinner, my friend put out her good crystal and china. There were 3 forks beside my plate. I put a personal ad in the free weekly newspaper and went out on a date with a guy who was a documentary cameraman. He showed up wearing black high-top Converse sneakers and soon revealed that he had gone to the same eccentric Midwestern college that I had, Oberlin, totally promising. There was just something he needed to tell me before things went any further, though, and that was he had once been abducted by aliens. Was that going to be a problem for me? I was knocked unconscious in a collision with a much larger car on a residential street in Hollywood. I woke up alone in a hospital room with no idea how I'd gotten there. For the rest of the day, I forgot everything I said or heard within seconds of saying or hearing it. But I remembered my name and the identity of the then-current president. Is it still that guy from Texas, I said, hoping, desperately trying to prove that I was well enough to leave the hospital. A week later, I finally saw the wreck of my Honda at a brilliantly sunny impound lot. The car was crushed. One could only conclude that its driver had been killed. I went to the Oscars at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. A documentary for which I had written the narration had been nominated. The director was seated downstairs with the famous, and I was in the third balcony with people's moms and cousins. I spent as much time as possible in the lounge near the ladies' room watching the show on a monitor. Oliver Stone passed me on the stairs and said, "How you doing, babe?" About being raped, the less said the better. I just remember driving back to the West Side very early the next morning, wondering if I was ever going to have to see the guy again, and if so, what was the right thing to say? Okay, so those are the flashcards for my 10 years in Los Angeles. Unmade bed, wrecked white Honda, Dan with a flashlight, shovel full of broken glass, ladies' room at the Oscars, red hanky on a lampshade, 3-4 place setting, black high-top sneakers, masking tape, church basement, driving west on the 10. I can think of several ways to order these events, that would make these images to make them hang together as a story, especially since we know the beginning of the story is I moved to LA from New York and the end is I moved back to New York 9 years later. The tragic version would borrow from the House of Mirth. Smart, ambitious woman works her way up to success, Knots Landing, attending the Oscars, only to be pummeled by circumstance, earthquake, riots, rape, until she is shuddering behind a masking tape boundary and finally retreats into a year-long depression. When she reemerges, the car she's driving is totaled, fade out on the concertina car. The comedy version has to have a happy ending, of course. Cynical New Yorker arrives in LA and does her best to sample all the city's best-known foibles, 12-step programs, Baroque therapy styles, reckless dating, gaudy award shows, bad television drama. Turning 40, our heroine decides to start behaving responsibly and is hit by a car. Clobbered by an earthquake and terrorized by rioters in short order. Luckily, she experiences amnesia and returns to New York unscathed. Of course, neither of those stories account for events as they really happened. Big shock, I lived my life in the wrong order. I joined Artists Anonymous and crashed my car within 6 months of moving, and then, still confused and disoriented, went to the Oscars. The boundary hem therapist was recruited to help me adjust, but he failed. During a vast, featureless middle period, I worked at Knots Landing and went on numerous blind dates, including the one with Marvin the Martian. That was before the earthquake, but after the riots. Getting fired at Knots Landing kicked off the year in bed. My encounter with Mr. Nonconsensual Sex was shortly before my 40th birthday, and when I saw those three forks at my place setting, what I thought was, I am so forked. Then I started laughing maniacally because it was true for a change, but in such a bad way. In short, amnesia was unavailable at every moment when it would have come in handy, so I moved. Okay, so that's the truth. And here are the lies. I'm going to start with the second chapter, which introduces the two main characters to one another as well as to us. It's 1993. Annabeth first met Laura at a party in the Hollywood Hills where a lady elephant had been hired to entertain the guests. It was in the spring or maybe late winter, at any rate on a clear, pleasant evening like so many in Los Angeles. It was late, and the elephant had been retired to the bottom of the driveway, available for photographs with anyone bored or stoned enough to step away from the hustle and into the cool, jasmine-scented night. The creature was wearing a gold lamé circus performance outfit that might have convinced small children that she was gay and happy, an entertainer by choice, but there were no small children at the party. "Stand back," the trainer said to Annabeth as she wandered down the hill. "She's about had it with this job, and she's got a temper." "Really?" Annabeth asked, not meaning it. It seemed to her she could do nothing right at these insider parties. Even the pachyderm was bored with her. She shouldn't leave the house when she was feeling this way. Her neediness was on her like a stink. "Are you my mother, Mrs. Mean Lady Elephant? Mr. Tortured Comedy Writer? Miss Unbearably Arched Indie Feature Producer?" "She doesn't like women much either," the trainer added, assuming quite correctly that Annabeth, with her skulking stance and her formless t-shirt, was not anyone he needed to cultivate. Annabeth looked more closely at the elephant's enormous brow and tiny eye and felt defeated. Nevertheless, she headed back up the driveway to the house. She could hear the giant animal's breathing and its anxious shifting of weight as she pulled herself uphill. Then the faint smell of hay or something like it triggered an emotion, regret, nostalgia, and she turned to take a last look at the scene, tarted up elephant, crabby guy in tracksuit, metal folding chair, BMW, Jeep, Mercedes, asphalt, cypress trees, enveloping lights of L.A. Basin. Annabeth encountered Laura, dark-haired, black-clad, near the patio. It was almost midnight, but she was just arriving. She'd had to park a good way down Holly Ridge Drive, and so sleek and though sleek, she was also somewhat sweaty. "What's with the elephant?" she asked Annabeth. "She's mean, apparently," said Annabeth, "and she hates women." "You don't say," said Laura. "How'd you manage to learn all that?" And that was when Annabeth realized she was talking to Laura Katz, the director. She'd seen Two Chevrolets, Laura's first film, at Sundance in 91 and had been following her career in the trades ever since. Photographs had not done this woman justice, though. Golden skin, eyes impenetrably dark. She was Annabeth's opposite, her contrary. Successful people always turned out to be beautiful, too. Well, successful women in Hollywood always turned out to be beautiful, or so it seemed to Annabeth. Normally, she would have been much too self-conscious to crassly accost this woman at a party, but it was already too late to get flustered, so she just answered Laura's question, providing additional details she'd heard earlier. That the elephant was a picture elephant. "So you mean it's in the Screen Elephants Guild?" quipped Laura. That their host had hired it to be the elephant in the room, so that people would discuss it instead of his latest series, a wildly successful, utterly tasteless sitcom. And that the handler was peddling a wacky comedy about an experience he'd had during the Vietnam War with an elephant in a starring role. "Too perfect," said Laura. "So you're Laura Katz," said Annabeth, immediately regretting her phrasing. Somehow she'd made it sound like an accusation. "I am," said Laura, half teasing. "Sorry, I'm not used to being recognized. I guess I should be a little more gracious." "That's okay," said Annabeth. "So who are you?" "Annabeth Jensen. I used to work with Janusz." "With Janusz," said Laura. "You were at AFI together, right?" "God, don't tell anyone that. They'll figure out how old I am." But seeing Annabeth retract, she added, "Jesus, you're skittish. Were they serving paranoia weed in there or what?" "No," said Annabeth, realizing a second too late that Laura's question was rhetorical. Laura walked ahead toward the patio's bamboo gate, but Annabeth hadn't really made up her mind to go back to the pool area. Before her visit to the elephant, she'd found herself on the outskirts of a conversation there that she'd found deeply disturbing, a conversation among sitcom writers. These were well-bred, well-educated young men who'd probably not fared well in the social maelstroms of high school and college, and who, in their late 20s and early 30s, had come to Los Angeles to exact their revenge. One aspect of their code of honor was that none of them ever laughed out loud at a joke, his own or anyone else's. The comedy guy Annabeth had her eye on at the elephant party was named Andrew something. She'd met him a few weeks earlier at a Sunset Boulevard pub where he and his fellow wits had a standing weekly get-together. While waiting for refills at the bar that night, Andrew had told Annabeth he didn't really like Guinness, he just drank it to seem cool. This had felt to her like an intimate admission, although probably only because she was drunk, and he had the comedy guy characteristic of looking meaningfully into her eyes while wisecracking. In any case, he had charmed her, and when she saw him again that night at the party, she wandered over to stand nearby, joining an ad hoc audience that loosely ringed his circle of humorists. At first, she felt perfectly content to be idling there, but then she noticed that the other bystanders were all men, the next generation of Ivy League comedy guys, and she didn't like to stand out, and she really hated the role of female acolyte. But when the wisecracking started to die down, she thought that the little knot of wits might untie itself enough for her to catch Andrew's eye. And as it happened, he seemed to look directly at her as he spoke, answering a question she hadn't heard. "Elizabeth, fuckable? I don't know. I think I'd really rather douse her in sterno, sodomize her, and set her on fire." Elizabeth was the girlfriend of their host, and Elizabeth, although blonde and lovely, had a summa degree from Yale in Middle Eastern Studies. Andrew's joke, as Annabeth ultimately parsed it, was about the unlikeliness of anyone ever doing any such thing to Elizabeth, especially anyone as fine-boned and circumspect as Andrew appeared to be. But, even among the comedy writers, in the laughless vacuum that was their air, this joke was not funny. At all. And that was the experience that had sent Annabeth down to visit the elephant in the first place. She had no desire to recount all that to Laura, but she did want to hold on to her new ally for as long as possible. When Laura reached out to open the gate that led to the pool area, Annabeth hesitated. "What's the matter? Is there some guy in there you slept with and shouldn't have?" Laura asked. Said Annabeth. But Laura had already opened the gate and stepped through, leaving her no real choice but to follow. So, over the course of the next 6 months or so, these two women become friends and eventually start working together. Meanwhile, Annabeth meets at a public library a guy named David, and sort of within 2 weeks they've moved in together in Venice. And he's a DJ on late night radio. And, it's unclear whether they both think they're in love, but they never really go through that phase where they get to know each other. They just are together. Very early on the morning of January 17th, David was standing in the kitchen when he heard the barking of dogs. It seemed to him later that he must have been troubled by the same thing the dogs heard, because he'd woken up anxious and disoriented when the world outside was still silent. When Annabeth opened her eyes, the clock said it was 4:30, and she was alone in their bed, which was shaking like the little girl's bed in The Exorcist, erratically, violently. She became aware of the window over her head, which usually did such a pleasant job of waking her up when the sun came up over the fence, and she understood that the window was now a guillotine. The shaking stopped, but strange electric sounds continued to shear the darkness, sometimes accompanied by blue flashes. She found that she couldn't move. She couldn't think of where it might be safe to move to. The door frame, a mere 3 strides from the foot of the bed, seemed impossibly distant. The transformers blew, the dogs barked, the car alarms keened, and she was immobile. "David?" she finally croaked, her voice sounding more peremptory than terrified. "I'm out here. Are you okay?" "Where?" "In the kitchen. There's broken glass all over the place." "Come back to bed." It sounded like an invitation to sex. Her tone of voice had become utterly unpredictable. "I'm barefoot," said David. Annabeth's brain began to pace. The electricity was obviously out and would be for some time, and that triggered memories of the riots, not even 2 years ago. Nothing bad had befallen her then. She'd essentially watched it all on TV. She'd even gone out on a cleanup crew the following morning, but in the weeks that followed, she'd become almost pathologically afraid of black people and their anger. There was something about the rage that she'd seen that night that she recognized. On the morning of the Northridge quake, she felt that their cute little bungalow on the groovy southern edge of Venice was now far too close to Oakwood, which is a ghetto. Maybe they could go to Laura's place, but then again, Laura's house is more or less straight up Western Avenue from South Central. Would there be roadblocks like before? Maybe it would be better to head for David's parents' house in Mandeville Canyon. Would there be fires? How much cash did they have? How much gas was in the car? David appeared in the bedroom doorway with a quart of milk in his hand. He'd been drinking out of it when the shaking started. He'd had the good sense to shut the fridge and then thought better of opening it again to replace the milk when the earthquake seemed over. He didn't realize he was still carrying the carton. In the shadows, he saw that Annabeth was curled up in a fetal position at the foot of the bed. "I think I may have cut a tendon," he told Annabeth. "I'm bleeding. Can you help me?" She watched him sit down uncertainly beside her, cradling his foot and applying pressure with the corner of the sheet. It was still dark in the room, but the soft white sheet was highly absorbent, and the bloom of blood frightened her. She put her feet into his nearby flip-flops and scuttled to the bathroom. She thought twice about opening the hot water tap, though. She couldn't figure out why. Would it dispense snakes and spiders like the little girl's mouth in the fairy tale? Her thinking was definitely distorted. Was there a gas line open that had poisoned her? She returned to the bedside and cleaned and bandaged David's foot by candlelight. His tendon was not torn. After she finished, they lay awake waiting. She found that there was something oddly soothing about the idea that this was, at last, the big one. They had no emergency kit of canned goods and bottled water on hand. It was more a sense of closure, of justice having been done. The Los Angeles in which she lived, with its fragrant night air, its hallucinatory jacaranda blossoms, its gleaming ocean, and its idiotic surplus of wealth, deserved a setback. They all knew that, didn't they? David was singing to himself softly, something about being sucked into a tar pit and eating cancer. He's a big Nirvana fan. What is that? I used to think it was just about a relationship, but it's really all this shit. The way we keep fucking up the world, earthquake, atom bomb, cancer. I've got a new complaint. Get in line. I mean, one day it's just going to be flat earth outside. I always think that whenever anything goes wrong. Did she? It sounded almost as though she was competing over who was the more despairing. But she couldn't let him keep talking that way. It was too creepy. "Why aren't there helicopters?" she said. "If the police had it together, they'd be flying over to survey the damage and keep the looters under control." "I've been hearing helicopters, haven't you?" Had she been asleep without realizing it? "Maybe, but where are the searchlights?" Then she told him about seeing Diane Keaton at the first AME church the morning after the riots. The actress had been unloading shopping bags labeled Matsuda from her shiny new land yacht, and Annabeth, in the back of a flatbed truck full of well-meaning West Siders, had found that funny. Later, after she'd spent the day shoveling ashes and collecting sodden drywall and being looked at with only contempt by passing pedestrians, she decided the actress's form of contribution was no more self-deluding than her own. David had been at a friend's place in Santa Barbara the night of the civil disturbance, as he called it, smoking pot with some high school friends. It was the last time he had ever or would ever smoke pot. I had this image of my parents running into the fray to offer free medical advice and medical care and legal advice because, you know, that's exactly the sort of people they are. And then before I knew it, I was picturing them being torn limb from limb by a pack of enraged black kids. Thinking of his mother, he knew how much she would be worrying about him right now. He wanted her to imagine him dead. He thought this, but he went on telling Anne about the story he had begun. We were sitting on the couch watching TV, and you could kind of see the mob behavior, except it was all shadowy, and who really knew what was going on. And then I looked over at my friend Philip, who is black, and I realized I couldn't tell him any of what I'd been thinking. And then I remembered how weird my mother used to be around him when he came over in high school. And I tried to apologize for that, and he pretended not to know what I was talking about. Annabeth nodded. She'd had no black friends in high school. She'd had no Jewish friends in high school. If David ever found out what a cultureless wasteland she'd grown up in, he'd probably reject her completely. She hid her face in his armpit, and he held her close, stroking her hair. They had been lovers for less than a year. There were a lot of stories they hadn't yet told each other. At dawn, they made love in a listless but soothing way and fell back to sleep afterward. When they woke up again, at 11, they were sweaty and tangled in each other's arms. When they woke up again at 11, they were sweaty and tangled in each other's arms and legs like drowned people. Thanks.